In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, you will hear Robert Fisk speaking at the University of California, Los Angeles, on November 14th of 2005. His talk was titled, Report from the Middle East.
First of all, my name is Yigal Arens, and I was asked to introduce Robert Fisk. I met him once before. Slightly embarrassing story now, he says. I was at a talk that he gave, and he talked about a database that he had of information that I was interested in, had been trying to collect myself. So I wanted him to send me that data. So I took out a business card, a USC business card, and I wrote down on it, please send me the database. And I thought that's not very polite to just, ask for something. So I added a comment on the top, very insightful talk. And I gave it to him. He didn't like that. He doesn't like the word insightful. He doesn't like people who use it. And he wrote about that in the newspaper using my name because he had it on the card. I have waited 3 years. So this talk today will be a lot of things. Insightful, it will not be. We are no longer stuck reading reports from the embedded reporters who write in our local papers, or worse, the reporters who are sitting in their hotel room and reporting what they hear from others or from military officials. Instead, we can hear things that are written by someone who's actually walking around and talking to people, and I would add risking his life in the process, but actually reporting from the streets of Baghdad, someone like Robert Fisk. Robert is the Middle East correspondent for The Independent, and the fact that it's 10,000 miles away doesn't make any difference because of the internet, which is an amazing thing. In fact, he mentioned to me earlier that he gets more mail from people in response to his reporting from the US than he does from Britain. His background, for those who don't know, Wikipedia is a great thing. It's even contributed by just random individuals who want to share with us what they know. But Robert got a bachelor's degree and a PhD in political science. The PhD is from Trinity College in Dublin. He wrote reports from Belfast for The Times before becoming the Middle East correspondent for The Times and then The Independent since 1989. He's covered in the Middle East many important events that have had an impact on us and obviously on the people living there. He covered the Iranian Revolution in 79, the Iran-Iraq War, the Persian Gulf War in 1991. He's one of only two Western journalists who spent the civil war in Lebanon in Beirut, or that period in Beirut. He's also reported on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and on the conflict in Kosovo and in Algeria. He's one of the few Western reporters who have interviewed Osama bin Laden, probably the only one who interviewed him three times. And he's one of the few Middle East reporters who actually speaks Arabic, which I'm sure makes a big difference. During the recent invasion of Iraq in 2003, Robert Fisk was stationed in Baghdad and filed many eyewitness reports from there. And he has, in fact, criticized many other reporters for what he called hotel journalism, sitting in your hotel room and writing about things people tell you in the bar. He's gotten many awards for his reporting. He's gotten the Amnesty International UK Press Award in 1998 for his reports from Algeria, and again in 2000 for his articles about the NATO bombings of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And he's been awarded the British International Journalist of the Year Award seven times. He's published several books, and his most recent book is The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. I think we'll turn to Robert Fisk right now, who will give us a talk, which is titled Report from the Middle East.
Ladies and gentlemen, I enjoyed Yigal's comment about the mobile phones. In Dublin, Ireland, some months ago, I said that if anyone's mobile phone rang when I was giving a lecture, they would be sold into slavery. And immediately a mobile phone rang. And it was mine. So you can keep your mobile phones on, no problem at all. I'm not going to give you a hard sell on my book tonight. I'm going to try and tell you why I wrote it, and also how it began to change my feelings about the Middle East in doing so. The writing of the book took about 20 months, but of course the contents of it took almost 30 years in the Middle East. The theme of the book, I think, although I didn't realize it when I started, is the necessity that we should refuse to accept the narrative of history as it is laid down to us by our betters, by our masters, by our prime ministers and presidents and generals and journalists. Part of the center of this book is also about my father. He was much older than my mother, and he was a soldier at the end of the First World War in uniform. I think in a sense this book is also an apology to him, because he was a very right-wing man and he became more and more conservative in his views as he grew older. He liked the Tory party in Britain, he liked policemen, magistrates, law courts and capital punishment. When he lay dying, I didn't go to see him, and I probably regret that now. So he is recreated in uniform in the trenches of the First World War from notes which my mother took when I asked her to interview him about it, and also because in the public record office in London I discovered that his battalion record book was kept by Second Lieutenant Bill Fisk of the 12th Battalion King's Liverpool Regiment. So I have his own record of who died in the trenches beside him, not only in his own words to my mother, but also in his own words in the official accounts of his battalion, the First War, lodged at the National Archives in London. He was told during the First World War that he should command a firing party to execute another soldier, an Australian soldier called Frank Wills, who had shot dead a British military policeman in Paris. Wills was 19 years old. He had been in Gallipoli, invalided out of the Australian army, wanted to continue fighting in the war, joined the British Royal Artillery. It was a sign of their desperation that they took on a sick man in 1918, returned to the trenches of France, got drunk and shot the British military policeman. I looked up Wills's details. Of course, he was eventually executed. My father, I thought it was the finest act he ever did to refuse that order. He too refused an order to go along with the narrative of how history should be written, that there should be people who would be executed pour encourager les autres, to encourage the others to be good soldiers and not to commit crimes. And I did approach Wills's documents, I got them released by the British government, with a certain trepidation. The dark black journalist in me wondered whether perhaps my father had not told the truth. I found Wills's last appeal for clemency. He said, "I am a young man and I promise to live a straight and good life from now onwards." He was shot at 3:15 in the morning in March day in 1919 at Le Havre, where my father was actually based at the time. To my great relief, I found that the execution officer was not my father. It was a different man with a different rank from a different unit. So my dad refused to execute a man when he was under orders. His punishment was to be put under court-martial himself. And then the war had ended, so his actual punishment, rather than being shot for disobedience, was to have to dig up the corpses along the frontline trenches and put them in the huge British war cemeteries that lie across the fields of the Somme and cities of northern France. On the 11th of November, 1918, which is Armistice Day in Britain, Veterans Day here in the United States, he marched his soldiers into the small French village of Louvencourt on the Somme. In 17 months that followed his war, however, the victors, the British and the French, drew the frontiers of Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and most of the Middle East. And I've spent my entire professional career in Belfast, in Beirut, in Bosnia, Belgrade, Baghdad, watching the people inside those borders burn. So partly what I've tried to do in my book is to explain to myself how this great tragedy of the Middle East came about. I've had the good fortune to have a researcher who went through 328,000 papers in my own archives and library, my own files, documents, propaganda leaflets dropped by Israeli airplanes over Lebanon, propaganda leaflets handed out by the Americans in Iraq. Without that help, I wouldn't have been able to finish this book. But it was a deeply depressing book to write. I can tell from my notes, which of course reflect my feelings at the time, that for the first 2 or 3 years in the Middle East, I found it a great adventure. I first wanted to become a journalist because I watched Alfred Hitchcock's wonderful movie, Foreign Correspondent. Hands up who's seen Foreign Correspondent. Not a lot. Oh, this is better than Britain and Ireland. Anyway, Anyway, for those of you who haven't seen the movie, Huntley Haverstock, who's crime reporter of the New York Daily Globe, is sent to Europe just before the outbreak of the Second World War. His editor says, "What we need in Europe is a crime correspondent," which is about accurate. Anyway, he goes to Europe, he witnesses an assassination, he's chased by Gestapo agents, reveals Germany's top agent in London, rescues a Dutch, kidnapped Dutch prime minister or peace campaigner. He is shot down by a German pocket battleship over the Atlantic, survives to file a scoop from an American destroyer, and wins the most glamorous woman in the movie. And I thought, this sounds like a job for me. I was 12 years old. When I actually got offered the job of Middle East correspondent, that then for the Times, before it went a bit odd under Murdoch and I managed to escape to the Independent, I was sitting on a beach in Porto Covo in Portugal. I'd been covering the aftermath of the Portuguese Revolution, and I received, a letter from my then foreign editor, Louis Heron, who had himself been a Middle East correspondent. He was at Deir Yassin in 48. And Heron wrote to me that the Times' Beirut correspondent had just married a billionaire German princess who didn't want to start her married life in the Civil War. It was 1976. And he said, "Why don't you take the job of Middle East correspondent? I'm offering it to you." He said, "It's a great adventure and lots of sunshine." Like a sword, I later discovered. Either way, the first few years were exciting. They were an adventure. Watching the descendants of the army of Stalingrad pouring down from the Hindu Kush into Afghanistan, watching the first battles between Soviet forces and the Mujahideen, not knowing, of course, that at least one of their leaders was going to be a lot better known 20 years later. I was present at the Iranian Revolution. I saw and spoke to Khomeini. I was present at the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War, that great Somme-like conflict, which did have a lot in common, trenches, gas, 1.5 million dead, with my own dad's great war of 1914-18. When he died at the age of 93 in 1992, I inherited his campaign medal, on the back of which was engraved the words, "The Great War for Civilization." That's why, ironically, I took that and decided immediately that should be the title of my book. By page 202, or 200, I think, in the American edition, somehow my adventurous life runs out. There was a moment during the battles across the Shatt al-Arab in 1980 when a British ship became trapped between missiles and rockets fired by the Iranians and Iraqis on both sides of the river. And John Snow, who's a very prominent anchorman on British Channel 4 television, then a humble reporter like me, and as I still am, he's gone up and I've stayed on the same job, with the same salary, not quite, but pretty near. In any event, he was tasked, for reasons too boring to explain to you now, to rescue the crew of the ship. And at one night, after going across this date palm plantation, which was half underwater and filled with dogs that barked at us and made the Iranians fire tracer shells and tracer bullets in our direction, we arrived at the riverbank, and there, sure enough, was the British ship. And John, with flippers, went into the Shatt al-Arab River along with an Iraqi military commando team. In those days, you see, the Iraqis were good guys. We were supporting them in their invasion of Iran. Got across to the boat and eventually hooked up with hawsers and pulled the lifeboat containing the crew to the shore. I was on the shore pulling the boat and John was pushing it, and we got him ashore. I had a mournful duty, however, because we discovered very quickly that this being a British ship, most of the crew were not British. And indeed, most of them were Sri Lankan or Indian or Bangladeshi, and they had all come with their duty-free color television sets and fridges, which they'd bought in Dubai. And it was my mournful duty to haul them ashore, welcome them to freedom, take their fridges and television sets, and chuck it back in the Shatt al-Arab River, because they couldn't carry it over the island. In any event, John got his film out. I took it to Kuwait, flew to Oman. This is before the days when satellites were everywhere. You had to wait till the satellite came up, and then you had half an hour to send your film out. And that night, I slept for about 14 hours in Oman, and I woke to have a telex pushed under my door, which had come from my foreign desk in London, which said, "Fisk, why you no swam shark-infested Shatt al-Arab River?" I read this to a dear friend of mine, this whole section on John and I and this ridiculous act of folly. And I said, "You know, there's nothing else happy in the book. From now onwards, it's all torture, pain, injustice, blood, death, ethnic cleansing, genocide, war. It's a book about how war is not about primarily victory or defeat, which is what Hollywood teaches those who haven't been in a war. It's about death and the infliction of death, and represents the total failure of the human spirit. And after that point in the book, I found it a very depressing job to write it. My researcher came down to my library one afternoon, and she said, "Robert, we're going for a walk on the beach, and we're going for a pint of Guinness. You've got to get away from it." And I think she was right. It's not a happy book. It doesn't have a happy ending. And I never want to write a book like this again. It's strange, having gone through so much of this agony of the Middle East and pushing it always together. You know, as a reporter, you go to the Iran-Iraq war, you spend 3 weeks in the trenches of the Iranians and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards under shell fire constantly, and then you come out, you go back to Beirut, which admittedly had a civil war then, but you go out to dinner, you go home for Christmas, you have a holiday, and then you go back to the war. But if you chop out all the little bits, the reporter's life, and push it together, you realize what immense suffering the Middle East has gone through, from the Russians in Afghanistan, the Iran-Iraq war, the use of gas, the appalling atrocities committed by the Iranian Revolutionary Authorities, of course committed by Saddam. And remember, there were more Iranians died of gas than there were Kurds at Halabja. That doesn't in any way diminish the Kurdish pain and tragedy. And then, of course, the invasions of Lebanon, the Algerian war with its throat cutting, which is almost a mirror image of so much that's happened in Iraq, and then the Iraqi wars and Kuwait and so on. And I came away at the end of the book, strangely enough, and this will not please all members of the audience, being amazed at how restrained Muslims had been over the last 40 years, indeed over the last 80 years. I found it extraordinary that after this blanket of injustice that had been thrown across them, that they should have so little struck out at the people whom they believe, not without reason, have a major, though not total, role in their suffering. I always have tried to feel that our role as journalists were important in trying to get people to understand what this involves. I used to think that our job was to be rather like, I suppose, Huntley Haverstock in Foreign Correspondent, to write the first pages of history, to be the neutral witness at the great battles, so that no one could say, "We didn't know, no one told us." More than 2 years ago, I had a long conversation about journalism with that fine Israeli journalist, Amira Haas, who works for Haaretz and who writes with a courage and a vividness about the West Bank and the occupied territories that no other Western reporter is brave enough to use in their own columns. And when I recounted my rather British version, rather boy's own version of what journalism was about to Amira, she said, "No, Robert, you're wrong. Our job is to monitor the centers of power, to challenge authority, always, especially when they take us to war, especially when they're going to kill people, and especially when they use lies to do it." And I think that's the best definition. I think that's the best definition of our job, or what it should be, that I've ever heard, and I always use it. Always, of course, putting the copyright stamp on Amira Haas. I don't know if we do that, because when I look back at the event which Mr. Bush has tried to claim changed the world forever, I think there was a great failure of journalism. I don't think, by the way, that September 11th, 2001 did change the world. I'm not going to let it change my world. I don't see why 19 Arab murderers should be permitted to change our world, though Mr. Bush apparently does. On September 11th, 2001, I was flying across the Atlantic, en route, of course, for America. Just before my plane took off from Europe, my mobile phone rang. In fact, I was already sitting in business class, I hastened to add, front of the aircraft. I forgot to turn it off. But we hadn't taken off, so I went back on the satellite pier that comes up because passengers are still boarding, and took a call from London. I was supposed to have a huge feature running that night, the night of September 11th, or the morning of September 12th, of new revelations about how many Palestinians were killed in the Sabra and Shatila massacres of 1982. The reality, by the way, is that about 700 to 800 were massacred between the 16th and 18th of September, and many of the survivors, about another 800 of them, were handed by the Israelis back to militiamen and were killed over the course of the next 2 weeks, often being kept during that period in container trucks. However, this revelation was not to appear in the paper because as I received this call, the features editor came on the line and said, "Robert, there's a light aircraft flown into one of the World Trade Center towers." I said, a light aircraft, that's not much. Then shortly afterwards, the phone went, it's a passenger aircraft. Well, that was the end of that. Then, just as I was about to take off, the phone goes again, two passenger aircraft. I said, this is not a mistake. This is not a tragedy. This is an attack. And of course, I had the aircraft satellite phone, so I kept calling London. And it was three planes, then it was four planes, and we were already off the coast of Ireland heading across the Atlantic. And I went up to the crew. I said, listen, you better tell the captain, if he doesn't know, that a very serious attack is happening in the United States. Captain came straight back, said, what else can you find out? So I was back on the phone to London again. And then I was talking to the crew, and the stewardess said, you know, there must have been a lot of them. They all wanted to die. They must have done dummy runs. Where did the planes come from? And we didn't know then that they were domestic flights. They could have come from Latin America, Central America, Europe, wherever. And that was when the purser and I looked at each other on the aircraft, and we went round the whole aircraft together, looking for passengers we didn't like. I found 13. I noted down their seat numbers. Two in business class, the rest in economy. The purser had 14. They were almost exactly the same as mine. Of course they were Muslims. Of course they were. They had darker skin, brown eyes. They were reading a Quran or using their worry beads or looking at me suspiciously because I was looking at them suspiciously. And I realized when I got back to the front of the plane that in 1 minute, Osama bin Laden had turned nice, liberal, friendly journalist Bob Fisk into a racist. I was racially profiling the innocent passengers on my aircraft. And they were innocent, of course. Of course they were. Because I still think that one of the purposes of September 11th, 2001 was not to divide Muslims from the West. Note how few times we say Muslims from Christians these days, so you've got a few in your country. No, it was to divide the innocent from the innocent. And that, for me, is part of the international crime against humanity which took place on September 11th, 2001. And one of the ways in which the innocent could be divided from the innocent was by refusing or denying the existence of the question, why? In the immediate aftermath of the International Crimes Against Humanity of September 11th, 2001, we journalists too, were permitted to ask the who question, 19 Arabs who claimed they were Muslims, or the how, aeroplanes, box cutters, tall buildings. But the moment you asked the question why, you were accused of supporting terrorism. The late Edward Said himself said that there's one taboo subject left in the United States. You can talk about gays, lesbians, blacks, but not America's relationship with the Middle East or with Israel. No, Israel was not responsible for September 11th, 2001, but America's policies in the Middle East, in that environment, are relevant. That night, September 11th, I was talking on many radio and TV shows when I was back in Europe. And on an Irish radio show, of all things, I had an interview which was hooked in to Harvard, where a Harvard professor, whom I shall not mention, was on the other end. It was Alan Dershowitz, of course. And he immediately said, when I raised the why question, to ask the why question is to be anti-American, it is to support terrorism. To be anti-American, you're a dangerous man, Mr. Fiske said. To be anti-American is the same as to be anti-Semitic. I've got the text, that's what he said. And I remember thinking, hang on, I think I've got the message now. If I ask the one question we've got to ask, I'm a Nazi. I should say that after this particular incident, and after I'd asked the why question in my own newspaper, The Independent, on the morning of September 12, I got shoals of postcards, all from this country, announcing that my mother was Eichmann's daughter. My mother, by the way, was a radio repair operator in the Royal Air Force in the Battle of Britain, repairing radios on Spitfires, which were fighting the Nazis. But that didn't matter. The cards went in the bin. Most of them go on the bathroom wall, but these went in the bin. Nonetheless, the fact remained that if the police come along to investigate an ordinary crime, the first thing they do is look for a motive. But when we had an international crime against humanity on this scale in the United States, the one thing you and we were not supposed to do was to look for a motive. Isn't that strange? You know, I mean, just to say, okay, 19 Arabs, they come from the Middle East. Is there a problem out there? Yes, that is the problem. I didn't doubt that it was bin Laden who was behind the attacks. The last time I saw him, and he wanted to see me after September 11, I couldn't reach him in Afghanistan because of an American air raid, and it wouldn't have been the same kind of interview. But the last time I saw him, we were on a mountain camp in Afghanistan, one of his camps, built originally, of course, by the CIA. And he said to me, "Mr. Robert," and these are his exact words, "from this mountain upon which you are sitting, we destroyed the Soviet army and helped to destroy the Soviet Union." Bit of an exaggeration, but not totally. But then he said, "And Mr. Robert, I pray to God that he permits us to turn America into a shadow of itself." And when my researcher, Victoria, came up with my notebooks of that conversation, and the great thing is, of course, that many of the things you wrote in the notebook, you didn't have the space to put in the paper, I found that I'd written three thick lines on each side of that paragraph and written in the margin, "rhetoric?" question mark. I tell you, when I got back to Europe and I saw those television pictures of the Twin Towers coming down in that biblical epic horror and the fog of smoke and dust spreading across Manhattan, I said to myself, well, my goodness me, New York is now a shadow of itself. That did convince me it was bin Laden. Now I am even more convinced. However, it dawned on me then that those notes of mine had a relevance I never dreamt that they would have. You know, during the research for this book, I discovered many of those missed opportunities which we ignore or forget about. One of them was the bright role the United States played in the immediate aftermath of the First World War, my father's First World War. If you go back through the records, you'll find that the NGOs of the time, who of course were largely Christian missionaries, Americans, and the diplomats, the US diplomats, who were the consuls to the dying Ottoman Empire at that stage, all petitioned the State Department in Washington that there should be one modern democratic Arab nation stretching from southern Turkey right across to the Atlantic coast of Morocco and embracing Arabia, Iraq, and the lands which we would now call Israel or Palestine. President Woodrow Wilson died, America moved into isolationism, the House wouldn't go along with it, and in the end, America didn't even join the League of Nations. I loved, by the way, attending the United Nations in September 12, 2002, sitting in the chamber and watching Bush announce that if the United Nations wasn't careful, it would end up as irrelevant as the League of Nations, forgetting to mention that the League of Nations became irrelevant because the superpowers wouldn't pay attention to what the League of Nations said and what resolutions it passed. However, oh, some kind of a miracle is happening down here. That's what happens when you talk about President Bush. In any event, when you move forward with the history, or go back a little bit to the First World War, you find out many much more chilling observations. For example, I'm just hoping those lights don't go out, then you'll really see I'm not reading from notes. For example, in 1917, General Angus Maud, commander-in-chief of the British Army in Mesopotamia, invaded Iraq and captured it all and ended up in Baghdad, just like the Americans and British did in 2003. And on the walls of Baghdad, he posted a proclamation. Private Charles Dickens of the Cheshire Regiment tore one of them off the wall and kept it in his backpack. I now have it, still stained with his perspiration of the Iraqi heat, sold to me by his daughter for $2,000, and it stood and hung on the wall beside my desk as I wrote this book. And it begins, proclamation from General Angus Maud. To the people of the Governorate Muhafazat of Baghdad, we come here not as conquerors, but as liberators, to free you from generations of tyranny. I quote exactly. Maud shortly afterwards died of cholera because he insisted on not boiling his milk. 3 years later, an insurgency began against the British occupation of Iraq, 1920. The first British soldier to be killed was called Colonel Leachman, and he was assassinated in a village called Handari near Abu Ghraib, which will be slightly more famous or infamous to you. I know Handari very well because in 2003, I went there to report on the first killing of an American soldier by a roadside bomb. His blood was still on the road. And when I was in Handari, I met the grandson of the man who killed Colonel Leachman, who pointed out to me that Leachman was murdered just 100 feet from the scene of the young American's death. The British in 1920, in retaliation, began an artillery bombardment of a city called Fallujah, which they partly destroyed. They then surrounded the city of Najaf and demanded the surrender of a Shiite cleric called Badr, not Sadr. British military intelligence, I've seen this telegram, British military intelligence in Baghdad sent a telegram in 1920 to the British War Office, obviously the Ministry of Defense now, saying that terrorists were crossing the Iraqi border from
Syria.
Right. The Times parliamentary reports of 1920 show that Lloyd George stood up in the British House of Commons, as more and more British people said that this is madness, keeping all our soldiers out there, they ought to come home. And what did Lloyd George say? He said that if British troops left Iraq, there would be spot on. That's the word he used. Anarchy and civil, oh, chaos and civil war. Alas, we didn't read that bit of history in 2002 and 2003. I did see, not many months ago, I was visiting the big North Wall Cemetery where the British dead of that insurgency in their hundreds are buried. 18, 19, 20 years old, the same ages as the American and British soldiers coming home dead from Iraq today. And through the cemetery, through the long grass, it's been long unkempt, was a patrol of American soldiers, whom, of course, I approached with the usual, good morning, gentlemen, because that's the best way of showing you're not an Iraqi with a gun. And I said, Sergeant, what are you doing? And he said, well, sir, we're looking for weapons. And I said, do you know what this is? And he said, no, sir, it's a cemetery. That's all I know. I said, read the gravestones. Read the gravestones. This is you from 1920. And 1920 is now 2003. This is a history of what happened to us. In the end, we lost so many soldiers that we resorted to using the Royal Air Force to bomb targets, which is exactly what US Air Force is doing now in towns near to Syria. Precisely the same. You know, even back, we're always going to rescue people in the Middle East. Not just General Maud. I mean, Napoleon, before the French expedition, the 18th century French expedition to Egypt, issued a proclamation to the people of Cairo saying he was going to come and rescue them from the pashas who allegedly were hanging people who had too much free speech. We're always going with our guns and our Abrams tanks and our cavalry and our horses and our crusaders to liberate the Arab world. And we spend a long time there and we don't seem to leave afterwards. And we always say, all we want to do is free you and give you the freedoms you deserve, and then at the first minute we'll go. And we stay until we're driven out, which has happened to the British in Yemen, of course, and Palestine, of course, and in Iraq, of course, and it's happening to us again now, as it did to the British in Egypt, as it did to the Americans and the British and the French and the Italians in Lebanon, as it will always happen when we go there. You know, I always use the same equation of the appalling situation which we now face in Iraq. That the Americans must leave Iraq. And the Americans will leave Iraq, but the Americans can't leave Iraq. And that is the equation which turns sand into blood. Yigal mentioned what I call hotel journalism. We have as big a problem reporting Iraq as we did reporting 9/11. I'm not against journalists who stay in their hotels. They have families, they're in danger even there. They have security squads hired by the newspapers, the television agencies, who say, no, no, you mustn't leave the hotel, it's too dangerous. Armed men sometimes accompany journalists, especially from American papers, wherever they go. I don't object to this if that's what the journalist feels and it's what the editor demands. He has no option. What I do object to is the fact that the journalists who write from their hotels, mobile phone, talk to the Americans, mobile phone, talk to the British diplomats, mobile phone, talk to the Iraqi government, whatever. They don't tell their readers and their viewers and their listeners that they're not leaving their hotel, thus giving the impression that they're making this great tour d'horizon, that when they report American troops have killed 42 terrorists in North Baghdad, that they've gone out and checked it. Because I don't believe the other day we had 142 terrorists killed by the Americans in Tal Afar near the Syrian border. I simply don't believe, it is incredible, impossible, because I've done these stories so often, that every one of the people they killed was a terrorist. It's not possible. And indeed, when Iraqis come back with film, there are inevitably women and children among the dead. But we can't check it out. You know, during the time of Saddam, the BBC, for example, always put a health warning on reports. This report was monitored by the Iraqi authorities. But now we also need a health warning, and there's no health warning there. But what is the alternative? It's what I call mouse journalism. It's what I have to practice. Because The Guardian, until they were kidnapped the other day and mercifully released shortly afterwards, and the Financial Times, and a few American journalists still, and Patrick Coburn, my colleague on The Independent, and me, we still go around the streets of Baghdad. I go around in a battered old Iraqi car with two Iraqi friends. I have no armed men, no guns, nothing. But what's it like? In August, there was a suicide bombing at the bus station, the Nafta bus station in Baghdad. So I jump in the car, street reporting, race to the scene. There it is, cars smoldering, corpses all over the road. Jump out of the car. I take two pictures, one of a baby burning next to a bus. I have 20 seconds of interviewing an eyewitness, and then I have 40 enraged Iraqis beating on the roof of my car. So what do? I jump in the car, little mouse, off I go. Mouse journalism. That's the only alternative to hotel journalism. And I'm beginning to wonder if there's any point in doing it. I could get 600-700 words out of what I saw and witnessed, of course. But is the risk worth the story, or is the story worth the risk? I'm increasingly coming to the feeling that very soon we're not going to be able to report Iraq. Every time I go there, it's worse. Every time I go there, I ask myself whether it's really sane to return. I will in December or January once more, and then I'll ask myself the same question all over again. But it is deeply depressing to reflect upon the fact, for me it's depressing, that in 30 years this is the first time that I've been confronted constantly with the question of whether an assignment is worth completing. I know the importance of the story as well as you do. I know how important it is historically. But I'm not sure that going there any longer is actually producing the reality. It's producing little tiny slivers of glass, fragments of reality, which we can throw to you, and maybe you can make something of it, and maybe we can sometimes, and maybe we get it right, and maybe we get it wrong. Yes, sometimes it's worth being there. In August, I paid a visit, many visits, to the city mortuary. Again, the biggest mortuary in Baghdad is not in a very nice area. So 20 minutes only, that's enough time to get the guy with the mobile phone who's watching you to call the men with the guns in the car to come and pick up this rather stupid foreigner who's wandering around without any protection. So I went repeatedly to the mortuary for periods of 15, 20 minutes. This is the main city morgue in Baghdad. One Monday morning when I was there, there were 9 bodies by 9 o'clock in the morning and 26 bodies by 12. Including a woman whose hands were tied behind her back, a young woman shot 3 times in the head, a baby shot in the face. There are death squads now in Baghdad. Death squads run by everybody, the police, Sunni militia, Shiite militia, and I fear the Iraqi government too, or elements of it. And I don't know who else runs death squads, not yet. I don't think Margaret Hassan was killed by insurgents. I'm talking about the care worker who was so loved in Iraq for continuing her help, especially for children with cancer during the long period of sanctions. What I found in the mortuary, because I got to know all the mortuary attendants, you know, it's an unpleasant job in the heat of August, counting the corpses, which are covered in flies, especially when the electricity fails and there's no refrigeration. When I got permission to look privately at the Ministry of Health computer, I found that 1,100 Baghdad civilians had been killed by violence just in Baghdad in July alone. Now, you work that out. I don't like extrapolating, but we know other people are dying in other cities. You include Mosul, Kirkuk, perhaps Erbil, Bakuba, Amara, Najaf, Kerbala, Fallujah, Ramadi, Basra. You must be talking about 3,000 to 4,000 a month. We're not talking about people brought to the mortuary with heart attacks or strokes. We're talking about violent deaths. That means 36 to 48,000 a year, which means that figure of 100,000, which was poo-pooed by Bush and Blair, may be very conservative. But you see, we don't care about the Iraqis. We care about our soldiers, we should. And we give them identities, pictures, names. In Britain, we often see them coming home in their caskets with the British flag over. You're not permitted to see that quite so much for your country, but we should care about them, but we don't care about the Iraqis. Over and over again, British and American authorities in Iraq have gone out of their way to prevent journalists finding out what the figures are, let alone the names of the dead. And this enrages Iraqis. And understandably so, because they are paying the price for our folly. More than anyone else, the tragedy of Iraq is that of Iraqis. Yes, someone is trying to start a civil war in Iraq. Someone is trying to, by planting bombs outside Shiite mosques and in Shiite marketplaces. I'm astonished at the restraint of the Shiite population. But there never has been a civil war in Iraq. The first time that phrase was mentioned, civil war, was at a press conference in the so-called Green Zone, which should be a red zone for the numbers of mortars that jump and fall inside it. This is the large presidential palace area, Saddam's palaces, which are, now house the British and American embassies, the largest US embassy in the world. It's really necessary to have that in Iraq. And of course, many mercenaries and US forces and US commanders and the Iraqi government and their advisors and the constitutional framers. That area, there was a press conference in 2003 when Dan Senor, official spokesman for the Western occupying powers at that time, started warning about the dangers of civil war. And I thought to myself, if journalists were doing this, we'd be called irresponsible. Where does this civil war? It always was Westerners using, and American journalists, and the New York Times, the dangers of civil war in Iraq. Not so long ago, I went to the funeral of a Sunni Muslim doctor who was shot dead, almost certainly by a Shiite gang of gunmen, in his surgery in Baghdad. Almost certainly, by the way, because he objected to the building of a Husseiniya Shiite mosque at the end of his road. And after the funeral, I was invited to go to the funeral feast, a grisly business of putting raw lamb in your mouth as you sit on the floor. But next to me was the doctor's brother, a Sunni Muslim, of course. And I said, echoing all my colleagues on the New York Times and the Washington Post, so is there going to be civil war? And he said, why do you Westerners want us to have a civil war? He said, we're not a sectarian society. We're a tribal society. We're all intermarried. He said, my wife is a Shiite. Do you want me to kill my wife? This is not a spokesman for the State Department saying this. This is a real live Iraqi, you see. And when you go to Iraq, you hear voices which you do not somehow hear in America or Britain. You see two levels of reality. You see the reality on the streets where people sit in their homes not discussing the referendum on the constitutional, Article 47 of the Constitution, but talking about how they can protect their wives from being kidnapped or their children from being kidnapped for money. A colleague of mine on the Irish Times went to the polling booths on the referendum for the Constitution and was talking to a Shiite couple and said, well, at one point, do you have any children? And the woman started crying and the husband just said, yes, we had a son. He was kidnapped last year. We haven't seen him since. This is life in Baghdad. Or trying to get fuel in a country which has possibly the largest reserves of fuel in the world. Iraq is importing fuel from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia at the moment to power a generator, to power the electric lines, to keep the fridge running in the hot weather, to keep food fresh, or to run air conditioning on hot nights. That's what people in Iraq are facing. And every morning between 7 and 9 come the suicide bombers, Walmart-like. Who could believe we would ever see 6 or 7 suicide bombers in one day? You know, when the Hezbollah were fighting the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, we'd be shocked to find one suicide bombing a month. In the Palestinian Intifada, when Palestinians blew themselves up in Israel, one a week was astonishing, or even two. But 7 in a day, this is Walmart suicide bombing. What do they do? Are people in Ramadi calling Mosul saying we need 3 more tomorrow? Oh, well, may we laugh. But at past 7 in the morning in Baghdad, whoom, you feel the air pressure change, the first suicide bombing of the morning. I'm still trying to find out how this system works. I'm beginning to, but it's very hard to get into. I'll come back to that in a moment. So, mouse journalism, hotel journalism, what can we learn? Yes, I do believe that the Iraq war was about oil. If Iraq's national export was asparagus or carrots, I don't think the 82nd Airborne would be in Mosul or the 3rd Infantry Division would be in Baghdad. But it's about something else. Some months ago, I was on Highway 8, a horrible throat-cutting road south of Baghdad, when the ground, I was actually investigating the murder of a Red Cross driver and talking to an Iraqi family whom I think had seen the gunman. And the ground began to shake, tremblement de terre, earthquake, as the French would say. And powering up the road was the biggest military convoy I'd ever seen in my life. It took 4.25 hours to pass. It was a roulement, they were changing divisions. It was the largest movement of men and materiel since the Second World War. Abrams M1, A1 tanks, Bradley fighting armored vehicles, Humvee after Humvee, hundreds and hundreds of trucks with tens of thousands of line troops, their rifles pointing from the sides like porcupine quills, and big Apaches like giant rodents going up and down, helicopters over the road. 4.25 hours, I sat in the muck by the road with this Iraqi family just watching them go like this, like this, like this. And it occurred to me that 2,000 years ago, a little bit more to the west in Syria, or Lebanon, it would have been the tramp of the Roman legions that would have shaken the earth. And it occurred to me then, rather late in the day, that superpowers, who make very bad peacekeepers, by the way, have an almost visceral need to project military strength. They don't stay on borders and look impotent. They must show their strength, and they must always go forward. And so, okay, we can go to Baghdad. So we will go to Baghdad and topple Saddam, and we will take our troops across Somalia and all the lands of the caliphates and across the land where civilization supposedly began, into the wilderness of occupation. You know, it's strange when you talk to Iraqis how they see this military strength moving. An Iraqi asked me not long ago in Baghdad, he said, you know, have you ever worked out where the American forces are in various forms, Air Force, military, special forces, bases? He said, they're in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Jordan, Israel, Turkey, Egypt, Algeria now, special forces fortress near Taman Rasset in the southern Algerian Sahara. They're in Oman, they're in Yemen, they're in Kuwait, they're still partly in Saudi Arabia, they're in Qatar, they're in Bahrain, right down to the border of Somalia. What is this? I'm still asking myself. Actually, the line begins Greenland, Iceland, Britain, Germany, keep going, Bosnia, Yugoslavia now, Italy, Greece, and then you join up with Turkey. A new Iron Curtain is falling across the world, from the Arctic down to Somalia. Why? I don't know the answer yet. But in the Middle East, they watch this, and sometimes going there, it's like Alice through the looking glass. You see the world in a quite different shape. And you understand why Arabs would like democracy. Yes, they'd like some of our democracy. They would like a couple of boxes of human rights off our Western supermarket shelf. But they would also like another kind of freedom, I think, and that's freedom from us. I don't think either that you can plant democracy in sand unless you have justice. And most people I meet want justice before they want their democracy. And I don't think we're offering the people of the Middle East justice. Not in Iraq. Not in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Not anywhere else. You know, most of the dictators of the Middle East are there with our connivance and support. I don't think we want them to have democracy. We want these people to control the Arab Muslim nations. Do you remember when Arafat, when Arafat, having been from super terrorist, was converted to super statesman, and he'd gone to the White House, and then slowly it turned out that he wasn't making enough concessions. You make concessions to one side only. After Oslo, and the question came, can Arafat control his own people? Now we're hearing, can Mahmoud Abbas control his own people? Abbas and Arafat were meant to represent their people, not control them. But we never even questioned that. We went along with the controlling. Of course, can they control Hamas, Islamic Jihad, etc., etc.? Abbas is a very colorless man, by the way, who in the 600-page Oslo document written by him for the Palestinians did not once mention the word occupation. And instead of talking about withdrawal, he used the word redeployment. It started at the very beginning, you see the slippage backwards. For me, 242, UN Security Council resolution, still remains the only way we will have a real peace between Israelis and Palestinians. How many times have I written the same formula down in reports to remind readers of The Independent what this means? Withdrawal of Israeli forces from territories occupied in the 67 war in return for the security of all states in the area, obviously including Israel, and an insistence on the non-acquisition of territory through war, which means that those who claim that it doesn't say the territories, only territories, simply haven't read paragraph one carefully enough. Ah, the miracle starts again. There must be a political pattern here somewhere that I haven't grasped yet. And so we find George W. Bush saying, oh, there are some facts on the grounds that are not going to change, thus carefully ripping up 242. Because what he's talking about, as we all know, is that the huge settlements like Male Adumim, east of Jerusalem, are not going to be taken down and evacuated as the settlements were in Gaza. And I think that as long as those settlements remain, the French call them colonies, colons, they use the phrase, we call them settlements. And I'll come back to the semantics in just a second of journalism over this. And as long as that wall remains, and as long as Palestinians are cut off from East Jerusalem, which has to be the only capital they can really acknowledge as their own if there is to be a West Bank Palestinian state, there is not going to be peace, I'm sorry to say. Journalists, once again, have a big question to answer over the semantics of that conflict. When Colin Powell issued a message to all US embassies in the region, that in future the occupied territories were to be referred to as disputed territories. Most American journalists went along with this, and so, I noticed recently, did the BBC World Service Television. So settlements have also changed their meaning. They've now become very often Jewish neighborhoods. On the BBC too. Well, literally, you can say they are, but that's not quite the whole story. And I notice how often the wall has become, which is now longer and bigger than the Berlin Wall ever was, has now become a security fence, like a garden fence. Which is one of the reasons why, if you live in the United States and you don't go to the Middle East, the reporting from Jerusalem or from Tel Aviv or from Ramallah is incomprehensible. Because if a wall is a fence, and an occupied territory is just disputed, something you can solve in the courts or after a reasonable conversation over a table and a couple of bottles of Ribena. And if settlements are just neighborhoods, then any Palestinian who throws a stone is obviously mindless terrorist, generically violent. Because by reducing the semantics of this conflict, here we go again, by reducing the semantics of this conflict, thank you, we are making it incomprehensible, and I suspect deliberately so. And this is a major problem, because if we are constantly writing in this way, our reporting becomes lethal, rather like our reporting of wars in general. I'm going to finish in a moment, but just give you a little cameo of what I mean. The road north, south of Basra, north of Kuwait, 1991, strewn with corpses, Iraqis and many civilians. With an ITV crew from Britain, I came across a large heap of Iraqi dead and Kuwaiti dead civilians and soldiers blown apart by bombs. And it was midday, and the dogs of the desert had arrived for lunch. And they were ripping the corpses to pieces, dragging arms and legs off, fingers trailing through the dust to eat. ITV's crew took pictures. I said, "What are you taking pictures of? You'll never get this on the air." "Oh," he said, "it's just for the archives. You see, this is the problem. I write in my newspaper every detail I see, however terrible, however revolting, because that is what war is like. But you're not permitted to see that on television because, for reasons of good taste, people can't watch this over lunch, over breakfast, over tea, over dinner. You don't see it, unless an Iraqi is obliging enough to die in a romantic position, preferably with his face, you know, still looking normal and without his eyes eaten out. He'll go on air, the commentary. Iraqis pay the price for war, you know, the cliche, etc. But if he's blown to pieces, you won't see his body. But if you saw what I saw in the Middle East over the past 30 years, you would never support a war again." In your government and in my government, there's nobody who's been in a war. Some of your guys managed to avoid it, didn't they? In years gone by, I think we went to war less willingly because we had people in the US administration and in the British government who'd gone through the Second World War, and before that, who'd gone through the First World War. Remember, Macmillan had been through the First World War. Anthony Eden had been in the First World War. That's why I think he was always full of self-doubt over Suez. He should have been in 1956. Another of our former people we love. We used to love Nasser, and then, of course, he nationalized the Suez Canal, so we had to bomb him. But this is one of the problems. By deleting the horrors of war, the television is helping politicians make war because they're covering it from you. There is a lethal quality, a connivance between television's coverage of war and the possibility of making war again. In 1992, I made a documentary for Channel 4 and the Discovery Channel here in the States, a 2-hour, 50-minute documentary on film entitled Beirut to Bosnia, How Muslims Are Coming to Hate the West. In 1992, in one of the clips of film, I walk into a burning mosque in a village called Chela in Bosnia. A year before, I'd been in the mosque. It was under Serbian hands, but it was still okay. I met the imam, had coffee with him in his house. This time, the mosque had been burned out. The imam and his family had disappeared. They'd been ethnically cleansed. And as I walk into the mosque, on film on that day, I say, and these are the words from the soundtrack, "When I see things like this, I think of the place I work, the Middle East. And when I watch what has happened to this mosque, I wonder what the Muslims have in store for us. Maybe," I said, I should end all my reports always with the words, "Watch out." When my researcher went back to find out the date I went into that mosque, it was September the 11th, 1992. I was just 9 years too early. Needless to say, the New York Times called it sensationalist and pointed out that Muslims were not coming to hate the West. Ouch. I suppose, too, what I should say to you now is that I've never felt so depressed in the Middle East, so lacking in hope, so appalled at the folly of ourselves. I, too, want still to end my reports with the words, "Watch out." I wake in the morning and hear the palm tree leaves clustering outside my bedroom window, and I hear the Mediterranean, and I say to myself, when is the next explosion? Today? Strange enough, when I've gone back through my files and television interviews in Canada, America, elsewhere, repeatedly in the late 90s, when anchormen have said, but surely, Bob, you're being too pessimistic. Come on, Israel's got peace with Egypt, peace with Jordan, the moral compass of Egypt, of Israel's security being a gauge of the Middle East peace, was always present. Over and over again, I say, but there's an explosion coming. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back when I say that. What I'm saying is that many people in the Middle East knew there was an explosion coming. We didn't know what kind, but something was coming. You know, I did used to think that witnessing history in the Middle East or anywhere was a privilege. Now I begin to wonder if it isn't a curse. And I think this book is the story of that curse. I'm sorry to be so depressing to you, ladies and gentlemen, but thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Robert. As I said, we'll have time now for question and answers.
Okay. I was there, of course, and watched it all. And look, there were two separate issues of the destruction of Iraq's cultural and political identity in those days that followed the liberation of Baghdad. There were the looters who swarmed in from the slums and the suburbs and who deliberately took tires off Mercedes cars if they couldn't find the key to the door, took photocopying machines, dentist chairs, money, etc. Then there was a second group of people who turned up in buses. One of them pointed a rifle at me outside the Quranic Museum because I pointed a finger at him and said, I've seen you before in burning. These were men who came solely to burn, to destroy. To destroy, for example, the Islamic Museum containing 18th, 17th, 16th, 12th century Qurans, which I saw burning in 1,400 degree heat. These people were bussed in. When I asked the American authorities, who were then, of course, the military, how this was happening, they said, oh, they must have been paid by Saddam to do it if he fell from power, to which my reaction was, not true. If someone gives me $100 and says, please go and burn the Ministry of Higher Education when I'm gone, I'll say thank you very much, put the money in my pocket, and when he's gone, I won't do anything. Well, I'll just keep the money. So these were people who were actively being paid at that stage. And this was a very professional bunch of people. My driver and I followed a bus 6 miles, actually down the same Highway 8, it was safer then, after they'd set fire to the Ministry of Computer Science. And clearly, they were put on board the bus, brought in from Hilla, Mahmoudia, Iskandaria, one of the towns to the south, for specific ministries. The only ministries that were not burned and were protected by the United States forces were the Ministry of Interior and, yes, oil, of course. All the others were burned, and the central bank. Whether this was to destroy documentation of the links between the Ba'athist regime and the Americans, I can't tell, but a lot of, for example, the National Archives, they burned all the Ottoman documents from 16th century. I found scraps in the street, complaints on paper to the Pasha in Baghdad about thieves, camel thieves on the Hajj, beautifully written and all had replies and stamps on. The few scraps I got are now in King Abdullah II's royal archive in Amman because there's no archive left to put them in Baghdad. In the south, in Samaria, where the huge ancient cities existed. There's been something worse than what happened in the Baghdad Museum, and that is squadrons of official, well-trained thieves have arrived, obviously with instructions to look for particular period artifacts, like 3,000-year-old artifacts from the Sumerian cities. So what they've done is they've dug their way down through the first 1,000 years and the second 1,000 years and thrown out all the pots or smashed them to see if there's any gold inside to get hold of the 3,000-year-old artifacts and then send them off to, we know where quite a lot of the Baghdad Museum. 1,000 artifacts turned up in America from there. Others turned up in Italy, almost the same number. These ancient Sumerian cities have been virtually destroyed. This, I think, archaeologists will later decide was the greatest damage done to human heritage. Not the Baghdad Museum, not the National Archives, not the Quranic Museum. However, most now, of course, again, it's almost impossible to go to these cities because of the dangers of armed tribesmen, gunmen, thieves, insurgents, throat cutters, etc. So that, too, remains a story which has been blanketed over. If you want to know what the official line is on the links between Saddam and the Americans, just reflect upon Saddam's trial, where the 5 judges have been appointed by the United States, and where the trial has been so structured that Saddam is not permitted to talk about his alliance with the United States before and after 1980. Best answer I can give you. You know, I really don't know. The issue, of course, is that people's personalities change after death. In other words, the butcher of Baghdad could easily turn out to be a martyr if he swung on a rope. Not, of course, to the thousands of Shiites and Kurds whose families were tortured to death and butchered by Saddam, but certainly in other areas of Iraq and certainly elsewhere in the Middle East. I mean, I'd have to say that, you know, we've all got this idea that this trial of Saddam is going to change the face of Iraq and people will realize he's gone forever. We totally misunderstand the way in which Iraqis think. He's yesterday's man. They've got more problems now to worry about, not the, you know, the circus and the free food from the circuses which Saddam represents. Strangely enough, you see, Saddam was always the more you got Saddam, the sooner you would switch off the insurgency. Remember how the insurgents were originally, Paul Bramey used to call them remnants, dead enders. Diehards was another one, all from the Wild West. We don't call them that now, of course. And the idea was, of course, that if we could just get Saddam, the insurgency would end. Remember Bremer, ladies and gentlemen, we got him, right? Now, three months, before Saddam was captured, he was captured in December 2003, I was interviewing a man in Ramadi whose parents had just been shot at a US checkpoint. They arrived too quickly and were shot. And he said, the resistance came to my home last night. They asked me to join. And I said, did you? And he said, no, he said, because if we win, Saddam might come back. And he said, but if they capture or kill Saddam, then I'll join the resistance, because we know we'll be safe from Saddam. And that is why the resistance caught fire after Saddam was captured. Stand by for the capture of Osama bin Laden. I knew Judith Miller's name would come up at some point this evening. I was waiting for Tom Friedman to pop up as well, my favorite. Tom's an old friend of mine, yeah, don't worry. Look, I'm going to answer this in a more indirect way, but because it's something I think a lot about. I think, look, there's a problem in European journalism, but you've particularly got a problem in American journalism, and that is the what I call the American school of journalism. There is a kind of osmotic, parasitic relationship between the US press and media and power. You want access, you want to be close. The Pentagon correspondent becomes an echo chamber of Rumsfeld. The State Department correspondent becomes the extension of Condoleezza Rice. You've only got to see this in reality if you watch a presidential press conference at the White House. Mr. President, Mr. President, Mr. President. Yes, John. See, that's how the sort of system works. And I think that this closeness to power becomes an addiction. And of course, you can't condemn or query those in power, because then you might lose your access and somebody else will get it, someone else will marry, you see. This is the problem, one of the main problems. It exists in Britain, but not to the same degree. The other problem is the way in which American journalism is locked into this straitjacket of being told you mustn't have opinions. Now, I object to this. You know, if any of you go on the street and see an atrocity, you're angry, you're furious, you think you know who did it, I'm allowed to get angry too. I write my articles like letters to a friend. I'm allowed to say I'm angry. And why should we always give 50% of our reports to one side and 50% to the other? If we were covering the slave trade, would we give 50% of our article to the slave ship captain? No, we wouldn't. We'd give it to the victims. If we were present at the liberation of an extermination camp, would we give 50% of our time looking for a spokesman for the SS? No, we would not. When I was at the Sabaro Pizzeria in Jerusalem in 2001, when a Palestinian suicide bomber slaughtered 22 Israelis, more than half of them children, I reported in great depth on the suffering I saw, the woman with a table leg sticking out of her, the kid with the eyes blown out. I did not give Hamas 50% of my story. We have to have a new kind of journalism that reflects reality. My editor, Simon Kellner in London, talks now about a views paper. Partly, of course, because in Britain, we don't have an opposition anymore. They joined the war, and Blair has become a conservative, and the conservatives all want to be Labour. We shouldn't have to be the opposition. We're also one of the centres of power, which should be monitored, of course. But a problem with journalism overall is that we need to stretch out and say, hold on a second. We have feelings too. How often in Kabul, in Baghdad, in Beirut, have I enjoyed dinner with an American correspondent who understands very well what's going on in the region and knows every detail of every political nuance? But when I open his story in the morning, it's as boring as hell. It's filled with quotes from some guys at the Brookings Institution or some other think tank, as I call them, who've never been to the Middle East, or if they've been, haven't been there for 20 years. We need a new kind of journalism. That doesn't mean alternative journalism. That doesn't mean unfair journalism. But we must be able to say, hold on a second, these guys have just murdered those guys. Look at the way in which the press still report the Armenian genocide. The genocide existed. It was broken by the New York Times. 1.5 million Christian Armenians murdered by Turkish, Ottoman soldiers, troops, and Kurds in 1915. And still, there isn't a single American newspaper that doesn't also print a paragraph which says, Turks, however, deny it was a genocide and say it was part of a civil war and that many Turks died too. It was not a civil war. It was a genocide. Armenians were put on cattle trains, in some cases, to be taken to their death. German, young German officers training the Ottoman army in Anatolia witnessed the Armenian genocide. And some of those officers turn up as SS officers in Russia in 1941 and 42, carrying out the genocide and Holocaust against the Jews. But still we put in that little paragraph, because we like the Turks, or they're good allies, and they're in NATO, and we want them, we need them. Turkey denies that it was a genocide. Incredible. I think that's the kind of journalism that should be somehow done away with. I think you're asking why American forces have attacked journalists in Iraq, is that right?
When yeah. Non-embedded,
sorry, journalists. Oh, right, okay, I got it. Look, I don't believe, unless it's proved to me otherwise, that it's deliberate. What I do believe is that there are virtually no fire control regulations applying any longer to U.S. forces. The mere fact that every time I see a truck or a Humvee, it has a big sign on the back, do not approach within 50 meters or deadly force will be used. Over and over again, Americans have shot down innocent Iraqis, much greater numbers than Western journalists, at checkpoints and have simply decamped and left with the car burning and the dead people lying beside it for someone to come along and identify. Over and over again this happens, and sometimes it happens to journalists. It happened to Arabia journalists quite recently. Of course, it's happened in the most blatant case of the tank which fired on the Palestine Hotel when the Americans arrived in Baghdad. I was on the road between the tank and the hotel, and there was no shooting going on, but General Blount, his name is, I think, Buford Blount, issued a statement afterwards saying that there was firing coming from the Palestine Hotel. That's a lie. Now, did they fire deliberately? I think that they misunderstood what a camera was, and that if you read Thunder Run, which is a book about the advance of 3 infantry division soldiers up from Basra, there is a quite good account which could explain it as being an accident. I don't think American soldiers are going around hunting down journalists to kill them, but I do think that the rules of engagement are virtually ignored now, and so it is inevitable that they will kill journalists, and even more inevitable that they won't care about it afterwards. Okay, first question, I haven't the slightest idea. I live in Beirut, and I'm happy to live there. Second question, you've got to decide that for yourself. It's not for journalists to go cheerleading and telling you what to do. You've got to have your own ideas. You know, you have all kinds of problems, I think, in the process of democracy here. We have a similar problem in Britain for different reasons. More and more of my readers, for example, and the paper's readers writing to the editor, both in the United States, but particularly in Britain in this case, are asking the question of the disconnect that goes on between the people on the Hill, or the people in Parliament in Britain, that you elect your representative, and when he gets to power, he doesn't actually represent you anymore. He represents something different, either the government or a lobby group or whatever. I think this is a growing and major problem in Britain, and I know it's been around here for a long time. A hoax democracy was how a US naval officer described it to me in San Diego some years ago. And I think this is a major problem, and certainly in Britain, where we're more used to ministers resigning when they've lied in the House of Commons, and more used to them not resigning when they've lied in the House of Commons, and I can think of a prime minister that would certainly have that applied to him. You know, that there is a growing cynicism. People say, what can we do? democracy doesn't work. We vote for these people, we tell them what we want, we march in the streets of London, we march past Downing Street, and still they go to war. And look at it now, and still they think it's a great idea. I think that's a very serious problem, because once people who believe in democracy stop believing that democracy works, then you've got the sort of atmosphere that existed in Europe in the 1920s, when people began to think that democracy was a decaying experience to go through. Look, people who say there will not be a two-state solution often appear to be saying that there'll be one state, but it won't be Israel. I think Israel will continue in some form or other. I think that the Palestinians will certainly continue as a people, but I don't think there will be any Palestinian state in the coming years that we're likely to see. And I think that all the various structures are being placed, settlement roads, continued growth of settlements in the West Bank, the wall, the change of the population in Jerusalem, to prevent that coming about. And all I'm saying is, as long as it doesn't come about, the conflict will continue. And no amount of roadmaps and Oslos and putting trains back on tracks or cars back on roads or whatever the cliches on CNN are going to change it. That's all I'm saying. Well, first of all, stop calling mainstream papers mainstream and stop calling alternative papers alternative and switch the titles around. Look, I know what you mean about the consolidation. Look at the situation in Canada. All Middle East editorials are written in Winnipeg, and all editors are requested to make sure they're the same. What do you do? I mean, look at the fact that the London Times, which I used to work for before Murdoch took it over. The French have a lovely word for people like Murdoch and Maxwell. They call them papivore, paper eaters. And it applies here, and it applies in Canada, and a lot of Australia especially as well, again. I don't know what you do about it. You know, as long as journalists are prepared to treat newspapers as businesses rather than vocations, you can't be surprised when the owners do the same. I regard journalism as what should be a vocation, and I think many of my colleagues do a brilliant job in proving that it is. Unfortunately, many others don't. And the degree to which journalists also give way beneath this growing ownership is amazing. For example, the National Union of Journalists, here we go again, was a very left-wing union in Britain, so left-wing I left it, effectively destroyed the independence of the Times and trusted up for Murdoch to take over. And after Murdoch took over, in general, the people who were ringing me up in Beirut saying, "Are you sure you meant that? That's a bit harsh on the Israelis," were the members of the National Union of Journalists. It was extraordinary how reporters can actually not show the courage and strength which they would be able to get away with, which they could use for their own, to advance the cause of freedom in newspapers and to protect newspapers from being under the heel of every papivore and paper eater that exists. But I don't know how you actually, unless you change the law or you change governments, you know, in Britain now, the relationship between Blair and Murdoch is so close that it doesn't matter what Murdoch buys in the newspaper world, he'll get away with it without the government interfering, despite the law, which I don't use.
Don't you?
No, nor email, no.
My question, though, is this.
Your books, archives, paper. Go on.
Yes. No, my question is this.
Which you didn't mention, Iran, which, of course, could well be about oil, couldn't it? Look, I think there are different agendas going on here. The whole Syria thing.
No oil in Syria, Mr.
There's plenty of oil in Syria. Look, the point about the Syrian thing is that there's a quite different agenda there. I think that one of the purposes behind all this redrawing of borders and changing the map of the Middle East is about weakening Arab states so that they will make peace with Israel. I think that's what it's about, partly. I also think it's about oil, of course. I don't think the natural resources of Syria have been fully exploited, but then again, neither have Iraq. Oddly enough, the Sunnis, the people we always say, well, they have no oil, there may be vast untapped reserves of oil beneath the Western Desert, but they haven't been explored. That would make the Sunnis as rich as the Shiites and the Kurds if it was found. No, I mean, the whole geopolitical issue is a quite different, it's a political issue, not a resources issue. And I think that's partly, I mean, look at the whole Lebanon situation. Most Lebanese are happy to see the Syrians go. I do believe firmly that the Syrians were involved in the murder of Rafik Hariri, the former prime minister, on the 14th of February. And one reason I know it is that when I named the people who were involved, my phone immediately got tapped by the head of the Ecouteur in the General Security, a certain General Tufeli, whom I then named the next day and asked him if he'd like to ring me for a cup of tea, since he had my number. I was only 400 meters from Hariri's murder when it happened, and I got to the crater and found the first policeman already taking bits of metal out of the crater and putting it in their pockets, taking the evidence from the scene of the crime, which is a crime in itself. The Syrians have brought a lot of this on themselves. But then again, look at 1559, withdrawal of the Syrian army, disarmament of the Hezbollah, disarmament of the Palestinians, leaving Lebanon weak enough to make peace. How soon after this is abided by does the American ambassador go to see the new president of Lebanon with a little letter saying, how about a peace treaty with Israel? Nothing wrong with a peace treaty with Israel, but not done that way. Yeah, look, I've lived in Lebanon for almost 30 years, and there is, so far as I know, no American base to be built there. I'm completely mystified as the Pasadena firm. I knew Hariri very well. I mean, I would go and talk to him often about various issues, and he'd sometimes ask me what the hell was going on in the Middle East because he wasn't always told the truth, so I told him what I'd been writing about. I don't believe there's any plan for an American base in Lebanon. I don't believe Hariri, there's any American hand involved in Hariri's death at all. I don't believe there's an Israeli hand. I remember as I saw Hariri burning in the road in front of me, I turned to a colleague of mine on the AP and said, don't tell me it's Israel this time. I think it was the Syrians, and I don't believe there's any American base going to be. Let me just say something very briefly about the whole internet thing and passing on stories. It's very flattering to know that you do hand on reports by Robert Fisk. There is a problem involved in this, which I'll be very frank with you about. The internet is a free organization, a free institution, and of course most people now don't purchase the Independence website. If they want to read Robert Fisk, they can read it on a dozen others, which are all set up in such a way that we get nothing from it. We have a problem on the paper, and that's that our foreign budget is a very hard thing to keep to. And at the moment, for example, I have to restrain myself from certain foreign assignments because we simply don't have the money on the foreign side to spend on the airfare, the hotel bills, etc. If more people, and this is not a push to sell my paper, but if more people could try and actually put a little bit of money into our website to read me legally, even if you're going to distribute it afterwards, I can't stop you doing that, or even purchase the paper on a weekly or a one-year basis, it would help to bring money in which can go towards our foreign budget so it can keep us working. Because flattering though it is that you can all read free on the internet what I write, it costs a lot of money to keep a foreign correspondent going. I mean, I'm costing my paper somewhere in the region of $12,000 a month, and that money, of course, is also being paid out to other correspondents around the world. We're not rich like the big American papers, which, if your views count, probably won't be so rich in future. But, the more you can do to try and help small English newspapers, The Guardian, for example, by putting a little bit of money into paying for their website if you want to read about the Middle East reporting, the more it helps us. That's all I'll say. I'm not making a sales pitch for the Independent or the accounts department, but it is a bit hard sometimes to find people saying, why don't you go on this story? And say, well, there's no money available. You don't pay for the copy you're reading. Yes, I was there for all the big demonstrations, the Minnestrone demonstration. The Cedar Revolution was a phrase uttered by the State Department, not by the Lebanese, and we need to look at it fairly realistically. Lebanon is a sectarian state, and if it wasn't, Lebanon would cease to exist. Its definition is the fact that it has to be sectarian, unfortunately, and therefore it's not a modern state, and therefore it doesn't work. Okay, but yes, I mean, the fact that, whereas when the Syrians were there and I was talking to someone at lunch, I would do this every so often. Now I just do this. I wish journalists were still not being killed and targeted as they are in Lebanon, still long after Hariri's death. But no, there is a much greater... I'll give you an example. My previous book, Pity the Nation, was banned for 9 years in Lebanon. Oddly enough, one of the generals who's been arrested for Hariri's murder unbanned it a couple of years ago. But when this book came out in the English edition, it simply went from the airport straight into the bookshops. There's a difference in Lebanon now. First question is, I think the Iraqis will decide the timeline. Yeah. And ultimately, I think the Americans will have to talk to Syria and Iran. They'll need their help to get out of Iraq. They'll have to talk to the Iraqi-founded parties within the government. Dawa and Skiri, after all, were basically nurtured by Iran. Remember, the Dawa party, whom we now regard as Democrats, were behind the kidnapping of Western hostages in Beirut in the 80s. They were behind the blowing up of the American and French embassies in Kuwait and the attempt to murder the Emir of Kuwait. They're there being talked to now, so the idea you don't talk to terrorists is ridiculous. The Americans will also have to talk to the Association of Ulemas and probably to those senior officers in the Iraqi army who now run the Iraqi side of the insurgency, not the al-Qaeda people, whom the Iraqis will have to deal with later. Last little cameo, and then we're finished. Just under a year ago, I met three leaders of the insurgency in a neighboring country, not Syria. in Jordan, actually. And the first one who walked into the room was called General, said, "Ah, Mr. Robert, we meet again." And I said, "What? We've never met before." "Yes, we have," he said. "You were under fire on the front line in Basra in 1980 when we invaded Iran, and I took the first tanks across the Karun River, and you interviewed me on my tank. And I went back in Beirut, looked through my archives," and since I don't use the internet, it was on paper, "and sure enough, I had. These officers, junior then, colonel and below, in the Iran-Iraq war, who fought suicidally for 8 years, are the men who are now running the insurgency. Not the suicide bombers," that's a little accretion which this book tries to explain, "but the military, the Iraqi army, are the insurgents, and they will have to be brought in at some point to negotiations. How you do that, I don't know. The United Nations has blown up. The ICRC was blown up. You know, the French had the same problem in Algeria. They were always looking for an interlocuteur valable, a middleman. Unfortunately, the French had murdered most of them in the meantime. How you bring these various groups together, but I think they could be brought together. I think the Americans could leave and should leave, and I think that there will not be a civil war in Iraq, and I pray not." That's it.
You have been listening to Robert Fisk speaking at the University of California, Los Angeles, on November 14th of 2005. His talk was titled, "Report from the Middle East." This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.